not only good looks.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, great. So this is actually going to be the last of our talking sessions at Rock Garden, partly because when we announced seven sessions, we hadn't really worked out when the feast was going to be, and then when we got the date for the feast, we thought you probably wouldn't want to hear me rattle on for 45 minutes before you ate. So this is it, and we decided to go with charity. So if you've come to hear about imperialism, I just have to come and live at my place for a while. I'll show you what it's like. Gee, we're awake tonight, aren't we? Good. Very quick out there. Huh? Yeah. All right, so what I'd like to talk about tonight is, of course, charity. And it's a good thing to talk about, given that Christmas is coming up. I expect all of you are looking forward to considerable charity from your parents. In addition to the charity they've shown you all year long, you wouldn't mind just a few extra, perhaps rather large slices of charity, truth to tell. Perhaps pretty ones would be good as well. If you're looking for this, by the way, it's just on the floor. And I'm done. Well, this is no surprise given where Christianity comes from. You understand, of course, Jesus was a Jew. Surprising, I know, but he was. And, of course, part of Israel's identity included things like the Lord is good to all, he has compassion on all that he has made. Now, that sometimes gets lost. Unfortunately, sometimes we get the idea that the Lord is cranky to all, and he really gets, pardon me, pissed off with everything he's made.
That's right. You heard it. First here.
It's not Sunday morning. It's okay. It's Sunday night. This is Rock Garden, so we can actually speak like people speak normally. We often think, you know, that's what God is like, but it's just not true. It's simply not true. So part of Israel's reason for existence was to demonstrate to the watching world that the Lord is in fact good to all. He has compassion on all that he has made. And for that reason, those Israelites were called to care for the widow and for the orphan, to take care of people for whom things had not gone well. And that was an essential part of their following Yahweh. In fact, if you listen to the prophets, you'll see that time and time and time again, one of the fundamental criticisms they bring against the people of God is that they think they can do this religion thing and ignore the needs of people around them. And you simply cannot do it. In fact, there's a wonderful passage in Isaiah. Just stunning. And they've got this wonderful temple they worship in. Brilliant, spectacular piece of architecture. Wonderful worship band. Wonderful service. They're praying and even fasting. Long time between fasts, I think, for some of us. And what does the prophet say? Speaking for God, he says, "Who invited you into my house to make this racket? Don't come and tell me you love me when the only thing made in my image, namely people, you sell for a pair of shoes." Really important to hear that, folks. This is not proto-Marxism. Now, God's not against people doing well, but he's very much against people who do well at the expense of others, and having done well, who care only for themselves. That's what brings God's most ferocious judgment upon his people. And why does he do that? Because God gets his reputation from us. It's how we look that tells people what God is like. Very important to Israel. They had room for feasting. They had room for celebration, but it was never to be done at the exclusion of others. It's very much a part of Israel's tradition. So this notion that somehow I can have a private relationship with Jesus, read my Bible and pray, and somehow that sorts things out, as important as those things are, if it does not extend to taking care of people around me, I am kidding myself. So people who tell us that, well, you know, that kind of social stuff, that's not the really important stuff, just do the evangelism, hear me, those people know nothing about Jesus or the world out of which he came. They know nothing. Doesn't work itself out in caring for others, then it's not really Christianity at all. And it doesn't matter how much you speak in tongues. Remember Jesus said, people come to him and say in that day, Lord, did we not cast out demons in your name? He'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. Now, this is not a guilt trip, by the way. Right? We're learning to do this. But I'm just trying to reflect some of the strength from the prophets and from Jesus as to a privatized view of following him that thinks it's just the spiritual experience and that's all. Well, it ain't. And we need to hear that. Now, Jesus continued in this line. Over and over again, Jesus talks about the need to take care of the poor, people around us for whom things have not been so fortunate. To store up treasures in heaven was what he called us to. Now, come on, Jesus, get real. Is that what I do? I don't know. How much of my income do I spend on myself? Oh, I can justify it, of course, because I need a Mac to do my work. Right? But I do wonder sometimes. Am I perhaps not really a victim of greed and selfishness? And maybe that's my real idol. Okay. Of course, I can talk about that very easily as a student because I had nothing really to be greedy about, actually. But it's a different thing when you start to get some income. And then there's all kinds of reasons. So I'm speaking to myself here. And if you want to listen in, you can. So Jesus warned those sternly who put their trust in the uncaring accumulation of riches in this present age. That's the one it's uncomfortable to talk about. We can talk about sexual sins. We can talk about people who have the wrong sexual orientation. We can talk about all those things, but never hear sermons about greed. Too close to the bone in North America. Much too close to my bone, so I'm going to move right along. Except I'd like to, but unfortunately this talk is on charity. So I'm kind of stuck with this for the next 40 minutes. And I hear the words of James, brothers, sisters, not everyone should desire to be a teacher because those who teach can expect a harsher judgment. Ugh. I think I'll just talk from down here. Now, not only did Jesus talk about this, but he gave his life a ransom for many. Now, it's quite amazing because he surpasses even the highest ideal of friendship as taught by Greek philosophers in the ancient world. The Romans, their idea of friendship was much more politically motivated. Greeks had a different view of philosophy. Of friendship. But one of the things they included in that was the highest expression of friendship was to die for your friend. And what does Jesus do? He dies not only for his friends, but also for his enemies. And as he's about to do that in the Gospel of John, the most popular gospel in the early church, he washes his disciples' feet as he has this last meal with them. It's a testamental meal. It's the meal you have with your friends before you're about to die. Well recognized pattern in the ancient world. And at those meals, you share the very heart of what it is you're on about. And Jesus begins that by washing the feet of his disciples. And then he talks about how he's actually going to live that out by laying down his life for them. And tells them that that is to be the mark of their following him. Right? Not the size of our churches. Not our political influence, not the quality of our worship, but the fact that we love one another as he loved us. That's the mark of Christian existence. It's kind of hard to do in the individualistic West, isn't it? But there's something to work toward. Again, this is not a weapon to beat each other up with, but it's something to work toward. It lies at the core of what it means to be his followers. Now, it would be just plain silly to suggest that it was Christianity alone that introduced good works and concern for the poor into the ancient world. That is simply not true. We saw it there in Israel, the famous code of Hammurabi from Mesopotamian Basin. Several millennia beforehand, talked about the need to take care of the poor, the needy, the widow. This idea has been around for a while. But in terms of the first century, as John McManus has pointed out, the Roman Empire was certainly no welfare state. Not only that, but Stoic philosophy discouraged people showing pity and compassion. Now, why would it do that? I mean, you and I assume today that showing compassion on somebody, having mercy, is exactly what a nice person should do. Isn't that true? In fact, we often talk, you know, we want Canada, our own country, to give more money to those who are less well off than we are. We just assume that, don't we? That's just the right thing to do, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't that right? You're not sure about that? Oh, I see.
Yes.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. Now I can move on. It wasn't going to happen until I got the right answer. Yeah. But the fact is, in the first century world, to do something like that was considered irrational. Why? Because the primary focus of Aristotle's cardinal virtues, the four virtues, the hinge virtues, that's what cardinal means, the hinge, around which human society operates, primary virtue was justice, and justice was always about giving somebody what was their due. You never gave anybody anything that they did not in some way earn, because that would be to undermine justice. That's why you never took care of people who are hungry or poor, unless somehow they earned it. Now, how'd you like to live in a world like that? You can't get a job and the government says, well, unless you earn this right, there's no money from us to help you. You'd like health care? Sorry, none for you unless you do something to earn it. Is that what you'd like? What if in your education you're expected to work 40 hours a week and then go to school in the evening because you had to earn the right to have an education? Because that's how it would have been in the ancient world. Unless your parents happen to be very wealthy. Now, what changed that? What changed it, folks, was a group of people called Christians who had experienced God's forgiveness, knowing that they never deserved it. Right? And you understand, we're not talking about the God who is PO'd at everybody. We're talking about the God who's good, who's kind, and who has compassion on all that he has made. And that was embodied in Jesus. These early Christians knew that they had been shown grace and mercy and had become part of these new communities that actually started caring for one another whether they earned it or not. And they began to put that into practice. You understand how revolutionary these ideas that we take so much for granted happened to be in the first century? And they're not peripheral. I'm so grateful for my upbringing as a Pentecostal. Right? I learned a lot there. I experienced a lot. But you know what? They did a pretty terrible job when it came to teaching me about what Jesus was really on about. Because actually caring for people, being involved, we hardly ever talked about that. That was for the Salvation Army people, the Salvos, and they never spoke in tongues, so we weren't sure they were really Christians in the first place. What a tragedy. What a tragedy. But the early Christians latched onto this. Lucian of Samosata, I think I might have mentioned him in an earlier talk, but I'll mention him again. He's a satirist and does not like Christians. But he complained constantly of the Christians' unbelievably generous and open-handed attitude to everyone. It really frustrated him. It annoyed him that Christians could be like this. He says, the earnestness with which the people of this religion help one another in their need is incredible. They spare themselves nothing to this end. Apparently, their first lawmaker has put it into their heads that they somehow are all to be regarded as brethren. just couldn't believe this. Now, of course, this is a world in which if you're invited to a friend's place for dinner, he would serve himself 10 courses, sit at his own table, and you would sit down a lower part of the floor and maybe have some bean soup and some stale bread. That's how people shared meals with their friends in the ancient world. Where you sat round the table had a lot to do with what you got to eat. Now you understand why the Christian communion meal was so radical and how far we have drifted from what it was on about in our present world. We have denuded this thing of all embodiedness and turned into these flimsy little symbols. Because we're good Protestants, it's just a symbol. That's right, and Jesus was raised just a symbol, and God created just a symbol. Well, of course not. Those early Christian meals were sometimes the first time and only time in the week that people would get to share the same food together in a radical move. When you ate together, nobody got a special serving. Everyone shared the same meal. So when you have the feast in 2 weeks' time and you all get the same food served, you need to know the reason that happens. Because it was not like that in the ancient world. What changed it was the story of Jesus. You understand that? You see, we take just so much for granted, folks. So much for granted. It hasn't always been like this. Certainly not in the West. Far more than giving a few coppers or maybe a piece of bread, early Christians often sacrificed their own meals for the well-being of others. So we're not the first ones to think of the 40-hour famine. Do we have that over here? I think we do in North America, don't we? Yeah. Now, is that a yes or no? It's a yes. Good. You can tell that I kind of live a lot in my office. Lord help me. Aristides of Athens says this: if the brethren have among them a man in need and they have not abundant resources, they fast for a day or two so as to provide the needy man with the necessary food. Hermas instructed Christians: put aside the money you would have spent on bread and wine and give it to the widow, to the orphan or the poor. Origen of Alexandria: let the poor man be provided with food from the self-denial of the one who fasts. Historian Michael Rechet writes: it has been calculated that at Rome in 250 AD under Pope Cornelius — Protestants can fall on the floor of heart attack here, yes, but this is somewhat before the Catholic Church, but I just thought I'd throw that in — 250 AD in Rome, 10,000 Christians from 100 days of fasting provided 1 million rations a year. Want me to repeat that? 10,000 Christians fasting just under every third day were able to feed 1 million people, give them a meal. Isn't that interesting? And then these were supplemented by gifts from the church. And what happened is, where did the church get its money from? Well, actually, some very wealthy people, looking at what Christians did, were converted and then gave their assets to the church in order to continue this feeding program. By the mid-third century, the Roman church was feeding more than 1,500 widows and distressed persons daily. In the late 4th century, twice as many were being taken care of by the church in Antioch. Now just think about this for a minute. What would happen if one of you got it into your head, because you've got energy and I'm getting old and grey, and I just barely talk these days before I fall over, right? Age is catching up. My wife's laughing. I'm in real trouble. Pray for me, brothers and sisters. No. Just imagine what would happen. Just imagine if one of you decided, you know, this is a pretty good idea. I'm going to start a program. We're going to get all the churches involved in it, in a given local area. And we're going to say, guys, why don't we work on fasting for maybe one day a week, go without breakfast and lunch or something like that, maybe 2 days a week. And we'll collect the money we would have spent on food, and then we're going to buy food and give it to the distressed persons living in our local areas. And so a bunch of churches, I don't know, maybe in Langley or White Rock or even here, begin to do this. And then it kind of catches on, begins to spread. So throughout the Lower Mainland, there's a whole bunch of churches doing this. And then suppose it even makes it to North Vancouver. People think this is great. And then someone visiting from Saskatchewan hears about, this is great, can I take this, right? And eventually, right, even in Toronto, of all places, something like this. I know, people from the West, hard to believe. God probably finds it hard to believe too, but that's all right. I'm kidding, just in case you listen to the tape. But suppose that began to happen. I mean, think about how the Salvation Army began. Did it begin as a mass movement? It began with just a couple of people. How did Wesley begin? With three or four students meeting in his university rooms. That's how Methodism began, and that's what led eventually to the overturning of slavery with the story of Wilberforce that we spoke about. It's not impossible that it could be one of you in this room tonight who decides to do this. And you start this thing. And who knows if in maybe 20 years or 10 years down the road, you have this incredible example of fairly well-off middle-class Christians, many of whose children quite well-off themselves, building in this habit of going without food one day a week and giving that money. What would that say to the Canadians who are watching us? What would that say? Might not be big when you start, but imagine what it would be like if that went through Canada, spread into North America. It might actually look like the first century church. And some of us could probably afford to... Imagine that. What are we talking about? Maybe $5 or $6? I don't know. What's the cost to feed a family for breakfast and lunch, basically? What are some numbers? $20 maybe? $40? I don't know. Help me, people who do this kind of thing. What do you reckon? You think maybe $40, something like that? Okay. $40 your mum can eat for a week. That's in... Wow. Okay. Yeah, well, that, okay, that probably should be taken care of, right? Well, think about that. And you understand, for these churches, this was not an option. This wasn't something you could do alongside your following Jesus. This was actually what Christian life was about. The early bishops watched over this, making sure that the money was collected so that the poor could be fed. There's one story about one of the church's most popular saints, St. Lawrence. He was ordered to hand over in Rome the church's poor fund to the authorities. He agreed, provided they would give him 3 days to do so. They said, sure, 3 days, we want to see the funds. He then distributed the much desired funds amongst the poor of Rome. And then, when the grace period was up and he was required to stand before the authorities and give them the wealth of the church, he brought no money but all the poor people he'd fed and declared to the authorities, these are the riches of the church, the poor who are rich in faith. Whereupon, according to legend, the authorities were not pleased and fried him alive on a griddle. But maybe, you know, it takes being under severe pressure from the state to actually help us to focus on what really matters. If you're going to lose everything anyway, maybe we start to think more carefully about what is important in life. Well, in the 2nd and 3rd century, there were two very severe plagues that hit Rome. The Plague of Galen in the 2nd century, which claimed somewhere between 25 and 33% of the empire. Look around and imagine that 1 in 4 or 1 in 3 of the people gathered here died in this plague. Pretty severe episode. The second plague killed nearly as many as 5,000 a day in the city of Rome alone. But it was actually the Christians' response to these two plagues that really established Christianity's superiority over paganism. According to Dionysius, Bishop of Alexandria,
He said that in the cities, when the plague came, the fleeing inhabitants would push the sufferers away and fled even from their dearest ones, throwing them into the roads before they were dead and treating unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal diseases. As soon as the plague struck, people would flee. Anyone suspected of having the plague would just be left aside to languish of thirst and starvation. But one group stayed behind, Christians, and began to take care of these people. Now, at no stretch were all saved. And in fact, many Christians departed this life along with the people they were caring for. Think about that for self-sacrifice. But, as Rodney Stark suggests, even with the rudimentary care that they gave, namely just helping people to keep warm, giving them water, some food, they probably reduced the mortality rate in the empire by about two-thirds. Interestingly, ancient records suggest that for some reason, deaths amongst the Christians were somewhat lower than the general populace. And that began to raise questions in the minds of first century pagans as to whether or not the Christian God really did have some power. Now, Stark goes on to note, amongst young religious movements, it's not the creed that they espouse that attracts people's attention. It's the quality of the life of those who already adhere to that following. This certainly impressed Emperor Julian, otherwise known as Julian the Apostate, who in the middle of the 4th century made a final and ultimately desperate attempt to reinstate paganism. And in order to get this rolling, he ordered his pagan priests to match Christian generosity. He instructed that in every city, hospices should be established so that the stranger may be able to praise us for our humanity. And not only those of our religion, but all others too. Meaning, he wanted all people, whether pagan or not, idolaters or not, to praise the humanity of the pagan priests. He went on to claim how shameful it was that amongst the Jewish people there were no beggars, and amongst the impious Galileans, meaning Christians, you found people who actually fed not only their own poor, but the poor of the idolaters and the pagans. He said this needed to stop. Ultimately, he failed. In spite of having all the wealth of the empire behind him, he failed. Why? Folks, we need to understand this. The reason he failed was because philosophy alone is not enough to motivate people to make sacrifices for others. Philosophy alone is not enough to do it. It's no surprise that you see Western democracies moving more and more toward individualism. Right? It's all about the individual getting ahead. There's no surprise. Because philosophy alone cannot inspire most people to do these kinds of things. And why did Christianity succeed? Because these people had had an encounter with the living God. They were convinced that Jesus had been raised from the dead, and for that reason, their future was secure. They could take these risks. There's some debate over when hospitals were first established, but it seems clear that the idea of caring for the sick without regard to status was a Christian innovation. Around 325 AD, early Christian documents ordered that hospitals should be built in every city of the empire. Now, by hospital, they don't mean what we mean today. These are basically places to take care of strangers who are passing through or people who have some health problems and can't take care of themselves. I'm not talking about operating rooms and ambulances and all those kinds of things. Nevertheless, about a century later, Gregory of Caesarea, I think I've got the date right on that one, founded general institutions of care called basileus. And these were places of refuge to shelter strangers and the sick, and they provided nurses, doctors, porters and guides. And then in order to sustain these people, introduced industries and then invited artists to come in and beautify these places. An interesting social model being developed there. There's a book written on Byzantine philanthropy and social welfare. And in this book, the author, whose name I dare not try to pronounce, but it's something like Poneropoulos, he's Greek, he argues that it's actually amongst these early Christian proto-hospitals that significant contributions were made to understanding of surgery, orthopedics, obstetrics, pharmacology, etc. A whole range of things. Being motivated by the Christian concern for people around them who were not well. What was even more heroic was that in the 4th century, Christians began to establish houses for lepers. Now you need to realise that people who did that not only had to deal with people who they really had no hope of curing, but they themselves ran a grave risk of contracting this incurable disease. And yet, eventually, over 3,000 such houses were established in Europe and Asia. I don't have time to talk about Augustine and just war, limits on war, but except simply to make this point, you've probably heard it trumpeted a lot that religion is responsible for war. Richard Dawkins often says this. Well, Richard Dawkins might be good in some areas, but he's not a very good historian. And in fact, a professor emeritus of history from the London School of Economics wrote a book about 10 years ago in which he actually analysed this. And he pointed out, in fact, that the opposite is true. It's not to say that Christians haven't made mistakes, right? And for those of you who have just joined us tonight, do be aware that we're not trying to tell the whole story here. I'm assuming you've heard the negative stuff. We only have enough time to talk about the other side of the argument. I'm not trying to whitewash the church at this point. Horrible wars have been fought by Christians. The religious wars in Europe, inexcusable. But the fact is, even with all of that taken into account, Christianity, it's been argued by this professor from London, has done more than any other movement to reduce the frequency of war. In fact, in the ancient world, life was pretty much about war. That's why Augustus Caesar is deified, particularly in Asia Minor in the first century. Because in his reign, he actually managed to stop a lot of the internal civil fighting that was going on in the first century BC. And they regard him as a god for doing this. Of course, the Romans then didn't mind inflicting this warlike behaviour on the Gauls and everybody else. Now, I'm batted an eyelid about this. But it really, again, was the impact of Christianity that has reduced conflict significantly. In the medieval world, there were two societies in Europe about the 5th and 6th century AD, and they were the peace society, if you like, built around the church, centred on monasteries and episcopal cities. And on the other hand, the war society of the feudal nobility, whose life was pretty much spent in incessant warfare and private feuds. Hence all those castles you see everywhere. Right? That's what they did. Now you see, the charitable ethic, which we take so much for granted, was not very much in evidence in general society in this period, except primarily in the church. And what happened was, as these monks sharing the story of Jesus began to convert various barbarians, including some very wealthy barbarian kings, those kings would make huge, mind-boggling benefactions to these monks, who then used it to establish centres of care for people, trying to build oases of peace in the midst of an otherwise quite chaotic world. So that by the middle of the 6th century, there were over 600 monasteries in Gaul alone. And they were the primary sources of care for the poor, providing aid and comfort during famine, and yes, schooling the children. Don't build your view of the church on Kevin Costner's Prince of Thieves. The Benedictine Abbey at Cluny provided for 17,000 persons in 1 year. That's one abbey. The Great Orders, the Hospitalliers, 1182, based its discipline on military rigors in order to provide strong enough bulwark against the disease that was everywhere. So you've kind of got military doctors, not that they go fighting people, but the idea was, given the times, they needed to have that kind of military discipline if they're going to get the task done. And one thinks, of course, of the Salvation Army. Similar kind of idea in some ways. It was during this time that hospitals became a feature of monastic life. Grand affairs having regular nurses, and staggering in those times, only two persons per bed. These were days when whole families would share the one bed. Interesting thought, isn't it? Right? Not only that, they insisted on good ventilation and waste disposal. It's interesting, but again, to just reflect on Kevin Costner's view of the church in England. Prior to Henry's dissolution of the churches in pre-Tudor England, it's true the church controlled a third of the land, but it also supported half the population, charging only 10% rent in good years and none in the bad years. And it's been argued that when Henry dissolved the monasteries, he gave those lands to his wealthy friends, who then began to raise the taxes and basically set about the pauperisation of England that provided the pool of people to work in the factories in the Industrial Revolution. Perhaps the greatest practitioner of caring for people was Vincent de Paul. You've heard of that movement. He said, every sick person should receive as much bread as they need, a quarter pound of boiled mutton or beef for dinner, the same amount of roast for supper, except on Sundays when they might have chicken instead. Those without fever may have a pint of wine every day. I think I'm feeling sick. Half in the morning, half in the evening, and if fish can be found at an honest price, they shall be given this at dinner. If they're unable to eat solid meat, then they should be given a bread soup, or toasted bread, barley gruel and fresh eggs twice or three times a day. So if you have this view that the medieval world was about people living on terrible diets and not getting by at all, think again. In fact, at Cambridge, Don has argued that the diet of the peasant in late medieval England was far superior to that experienced by the working classes during the Industrial Revolution. Catholic Europe was crisscrossed with a network of organisations designed to help the poor and sick. And in Protestant Europe, when those religious orders dissipated, the gap was filled by voluntary organisations. Now, this interest in medicine, the welfare of others, I should say, actually is what lay behind the early advances in medicine in Western Europe. The Benedictines, not just given to prayer, they actually produced a long series of medical works right up into the 16th century. We're talking about the late medieval period, characterized not by myth or superstition, but instead by empirical observation. And you can see this trend to explain what they saw in rational and theoretical terms. And they began then to solve definite medical and surgical problems. Right? This is the legacy of Benedictine monks. And we talked about that in terms of the rise of science, but the same thing was going on in the realm of medicine. In terms of human anatomy, discovering what makes up the body, it's not the Greeks, the Romans, the Muslims, or the Chinese who actually began to base their anatomy on human dissection. No. Who did this? It was the medieval scholastics, much maligned by the Enlightenment propagandists. They are the ones who began to realise, if you want to know how to care for people, you need to start looking at the human body. Now, I don't know if you grew up with this myth. I did. I had this myth taught to me that the church frowned on anybody dissecting bodies, so the real heroes of science would creep out at night, right? quietly dig up a body, run for their lives, and advance the parameters of human learning, right? Trying to keep away from the clutches of this wicked church that wanted to keep everybody benighted. Well, it's absolutely bogus. That's not what happened at all. Public dissections were happening in 1315 in major cities in Italy, in church-run universities. Why was that happening? It grew out of the fact that Jesus said, you need to love one another as I have loved you. And you love people regardless of their status. So you start taking care of everybody. And what does it mean to take care of people? Then you start learning about medicine. You start working on the human body. It actually goes back to the medieval scholastics. They began this, and without their work, there would be no modern medicine as we know it. But charity is not just about helping people who are poor, hungry. It's about education. Here's another great myth, that Christians are opposed to education and thinking. Well, it's just ridiculous. The fact is, for many centuries, the only places in which education took place were the monasteries. You might have read the book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, and it wasn't just Guinness. It was also Kilkenny. We have a Kilkenny fan. Oh, good, good man. Yes, well done. I guess there's a book coming out on the Scots doing this. It'll be their invention of whiskey or something. In any case, the Irish saved civilization. When Europe had kind of fallen under this dark cloud, it was Irish Christian monks that kept alive the learning of the West. Often in just almost unendurably harsh conditions, painstakingly copying and disseminating the learning of the Western world. Christians. So this silly idea that somehow Christians are opposed to learning is ridiculous. It's also true that, in fact, if you look at evangelicals, you know, in terms of people who send their children to university, right, who are interested in further education, evangelicals are right up there, front rank. As we'll see in just a moment when we talk about the parameters that define the most charitable group in Canada today. We'll get to that in just a moment. It was actually Christian medieval Europe that founded universities. That's right. The modern university is a Christian innovation. Ta-da. You might never guess that from the quality of some of the sermons you hear on television these days, but it's true. And we're hoping we might reclaim some of this, and perhaps some of you will be the ones who can begin to do it. You know the people who are most behind it? Ever heard of St. Francis? St. Francis of the fields with the flowers and the birds and not too many of the bees, apparently. He's a monk, after all. Good, okay, yeah, someone's awake. Franciscans, yes, Franciscans. Deeply committed to education. Now, has anyone here seen The Name of the Rose? Have you seen that? Don't put your hands up too high because mum and dad will know and you're in strife. Right? What's really interesting about that film is you have this picture of the church that really is kind of corrupt and not interested in education and blinded. And the Franciscans are caught up in that, except for William of Baskerville, played by, I've forgotten his name, Sean Connery. Used to be one of my favourite actors, getting a bit old now. But then so am I, so he's still one of my favourite actors. And, you know, he becomes the model of this new Enlightenment person, as though somehow the Franciscans were divided, and it's this wild guy, in one sense, who refuses to go along with the mainstream Franciscans, who, you know, represents the wave of the future. Oh, rhubarb! The Franciscans and Dominicans, deeply committed to education, founding universities. And they did it so well because this is our Father's world. And part of our worshipping Him is to learn about it. Right? So please don't waste your education if that's where your gifts lie. Now, if your gifts don't lie there, that's fine, right? No problem about that. But if God has gifted you and you find yourself at university, please don't slack off. Don't dishonor God by giving your time at university some kind of, pardon me, half-assed attitude. Don't do that. That is dishonoring to God. And if you think the language is bad, then I tell you what, he's not going to get so much fussed about the language as he will with people who waste an opportunity that he gives them to learn about his word. Right? Frankly, it's just a sign of, I think, of how far we've missed this. We get upset about the language and we don't really care too much about wasting our time when we get this tremendous opportunity to honor him and serve him by doing things well. All part of this profound Christian tradition, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, and they do this well, so that these universities soon become the pampered darlings of kings and potentates. You can read records of cities trying to entice universities to come to their city because they know when they do, the king's going to pour money. Why? They're religious institutions. Priests, monks, teaching. And not just reiterating dogma. It's just not true. These people weren't afraid to challenge the status quo. What do you think Luther was? A monk challenging the status quo. He happened to be confronted with a fairly corrupt pope, which created some problems. But throughout the universities of Western Europe, there are people pushing the boundaries, questioning Aristotle, going on their senses. That's where modern science begins. Looking at the world around them. They studied, they debated, they found ways to shape their thinking. Doing. That's basically what the Italians are doing, aping classical manners. But the real revival in education happened before that, in the Christian universities. Anselm, in the 11th century, was already emphasizing the importance of thinking through theology, the role of reason in understanding the world. Using your mind and being reasonable did not begin with the Enlightenment. Christians were doing this long before that was ever thought of. Towering achievements of Aquinas, Albertus Magnus, just to name a couple from the 13th century. Seeking to classify all knowledge. If you've seen The Name of the Rose, you recognize that library. It looks like an Escher sketch. There's a reason Umberto Eco has chosen that model, because it was the Christian view of the world that made some sense of what it meant to be alive. And if you haven't learned anything from postmodernism, at least learn this. The postmodernists are right. Human beings, in and of their own intellectual endeavor, cannot make sense of what it means to be a human being. Cannot make sense. At least the postmodernists have the intellectual integrity to tell us that. The modernists thought simply by human rationality we could make some sense of life. We can't. And Umberto Eco recognized that. So he portrays the library in this monastery as a beautifully organized system. Now, we don't quite share the view of the system that they had. Nevertheless, we recognize that there is an orderness to the universe, and the only way to really understand it is by knowing the God who created it in the first place. I have a friend, Stephen Meyer, who did his PhD at Cambridge when I was there. One of the sharpest people I know. He had what's called an American Friends of Cambridge scholarship, only goes to the top two or three American students in Cambridge. I do have to tell you, by the way, the sharpest people I met at Cambridge were not the Brits. It was our neighbours to the south, who I'm sure they're not all like that. But I tell you, incredibly well-read, incredibly articulate. And I've been around a bit, but I was quite staggered by just the education of some of these people. Right? Well, this guy, Stephen Meyer, is a Christian. And he just recently published an article that I noticed today has caused a furor. He did his work on the history of philosophy of science and the question of origin, something no one really wants to talk about these days. He's basically argued that it is impossible to explain the emergence of DNA through purely natural causes. Goes through the article. It's all in detail. It's there in detail. If you want to read it, go to the Discovery Institute website, Discovery Institute website in Seattle, and read this thing. It passed peer review from three other scientists. The editor of this journal has two PhDs in evolutionary science. He said, yep, this article's... Well, it has just caused everything to hit the fan. People are furious. Boy, if you didn't think there was an Inquisition today, think again. There are really some sacred cows you can't raise questions about. And evolutionary theory is one of them. Now, I'm not arguing that because I think Genesis 1 happened in 7 days. You know what I think about that. That's not what it's talking about. Clear on the grounds of science. Stephen Meyer simply stands in the same tradition of Christians who recognize that thinking about God's world is part of the way of worshipping Him. Well, medieval Christians were the ones who rationalized trials so that orderly procedures were followed. Do you know that a large amount of our modern law code rests on the development of Catholic legal scholars from the medieval period? Do you know that? When you go for trial and there's a rational process and requirement for evidence, do you know where that comes from? Not from Rome. Oh yes, everyone's meant to be under the law in Rome. That's true. Everyone's equal under the law. But the procedure of following this rational process, that is a Christian innovation. Coming out of medieval universities, people trying to work out what it meant to do the law justly, and that's why, as we said a couple of weeks ago, the first protests against witch trials came from Catholic scholars, Jesuits, because they recognized the evidence simply could not be trusted and they were concerned about doing justice. That's the Christian tradition. That's our tradition. We're people who are concerned that when someone goes to court, justice gets done. And at the same time, we're people who are concerned about mercy, compassion, and charity. Evangelical awakening under Wesley. Innumerable social reforms. Some of the earliest convicts to Australia were Wesleyans. And you know why they were there? The Toll Puddle Martyrs. They were there because they recognised that wealthy English landholders were abusing their workers, and these Wesleyan Christians understood to follow Jesus meant you had to love your neighbour as yourself, and they stood up against this and were sent to Van Diemen's Land for their troubles. Such was their Christian faith. There's a guy from this church who dared to raise questions about abortion and went to prison for it, from this church. And how many people stood up to protest what I think is an unjust law? Two. Two people out of the Christian community in the Lower Mainland. Two people. Where are the rest of us? Do you know that this country is the only country in the Western world that has no laws about abortion? No laws at all? The only country in the Western world. And we have a government who won't handle it because it doesn't have the moral courage, and it undermines our democratic system by forcing those decisions on judges whom you and I do not elect. You realise just how dangerous that is, folks? Giving that kind of power to people whom you don't elect? When our forefathers and foremothers, all eight of them, fought hard to give us these kinds of freedoms? Even we crazy Australians are opening up the debate now. And Australia is not a Christian country. But in the last 2 or 3 weeks, All kinds of people are saying there are too many abortions in Australia, and now it's slowly coming out, all of the health costs to women. Do you know a woman who has an abortion is 6.5 times more likely to die in the next couple of years than a woman who carries a baby the full term? Did you know that? You know where that study comes from? From Finland, where they've been keeping records for the past 30 or 40 years. Finland's hardly a Christian country. It's slowly coming out. People in Australia are slowly beginning to say, you know what? We've been there and seen babies lying in trays, taking over an hour and a half to die, crying and left to die. And it's non-Christians who are saying, this has got to stop. Now, they're not saying no abortion at all, but they are saying our culture's gone too far. We just cannot treat people like this. And you're not doing this because you don't like women. It's just the health risks connected with this kind of thing are really, really serious. When did you last read about those in your media? When did you last pick up a newspaper and see those things talked about? They're out there. The medical studies have been done. Why don't we hear about them? Now, this is not a crusade. It's not about that. It's about caring both for the women and the children. Wesleyans knew about these things. Wesley knew that to follow Jesus meant you had to get involved in these other things. They were involved in prison reform. The beginning of the early, you know, the first unions were founded by Christians to protect the workers. The old NDP has certainly shifted a long way from where it began. But it might just be because maybe a lot of Christians just stopped being involved in politics. I thought, gee, we'll just wait here until Jesus comes. Well, you know what? It just might happen when he comes. We are the ones who get left behind. He might just say to us, depart from me, I never knew you. But Lord, we attended worship services. We kept away from the world. We stayed pure. I never knew you. I'm suggesting everyone has to get in politics. I'm not saying that. We'll come back to the Canadian thing in just a few minutes as we bring this to a close. In a few minutes, we'll bring it to a close. I want to get back to the Canadian thing then. We've already talked about Wilberforce, the Scottish industrialists, these early Presbyterians. Right? If you're an entrepreneur, praise God. Imitate these guys. Entrepreneurs, what did they do? They built their factories, but they also rebuilt the villages in which their workers lived so that they have proper sanitation, lighting, housing, provided doctors and education. Now, that's a model of a Christian business person. By all means, be an entrepreneur, right? People need money to live. If you've got the gift of creating wealth, God bless you. I haven't. I've got the gift of spending it to buy books. That's about it. But if you've got that gift, then celebrate it. It's a God-given gift. To give somebody a job is a beautiful thing. Ask the person who's trying to get by on nothing what it's like to have a job. And a job that actually affirms their identity. If that's your gift, then it ought to be lauded and celebrated. But it's not just about me. Be a wonderful thing to start seeing Christian business people whose businesses are going well beginning to say to their workers, okay, look, I want to provide for you in certain ways. My wife's father, an amazing guy. Father was killed in World War I. Lived on a little country farm in Victoria. Managed to make his way up until he actually became a developer and quite good at it. Specialised in building roads, and actually for General Motors in Australia, he was responsible for building the high-speed turn and their trial track, which is quite something. Then we got a new government, and the government began to institute some different economic policies, which basically undermined all the middle business people in Australia. We're still trying to recover from this, actually. And the amazing thing about Katie's dad was when he knew he was going broke, you know what he said to his workers? He said, you help me get this money, so I'm going to keep you employed until it's gone. And people around him had sacked their workers, right? But he kept them employed until it came down to his house. I think he said, look, when it comes down to my house, then we'll have to stop. But he kept them employed for a couple of years when they were making no money. He was just paying out, paying out, paying out to care for them. Right? When he died, scores of people turned up to his funeral in this little country church. And there was a moment when people could stand up and speak. And time and again, people that we knew nothing of would stand up and say, I'm here, you probably don't know me, but I just want to tell you that when we were hard up and had nothing to eat, Ian Noble would always make sure there were groceries on the table. Right? That's the man of whom God will say, after my own heart. It's powerful. Great model for business people. Salvation Army, do we need to talk about them? From small beginnings, during the Great Depression, provided 100,000 meals and 25,000 lodgings a week in New York alone. Today, they operate in 80 countries, maintaining 16,000 evangelical centers and more than 3,000 social welfare institutions. And if they pulled out, the whole lot would come crashing down in many, many countries around the world. In fact, in the US, they attract more money than the Red Cross or the Cancer Society. So trusted are they. This trend continues with the Puritans and the New World. Education, schooling. Do you know most of the major educational facilities in the US were actually founded by Christians? Yale, Harvard, Princeton. Christian institutions. Not with government money, funded by Christians themselves. Why? Because they believed in education. God takes no glory in ignorant Christians. The Catholics had an immense educational network, and in the 1950s had over 500 hospitals in the US alone, funded by the church. It's a tragedy that some of those people who operated in those places used their calling as a cloak for sexual predatory behavior. It's inexcusable. And that some people turned a blind eye to it is even worse. But to be fair, that ought not take away from the work of those who did not engage in such practices and have given themselves to caring for others. What about the missionaries? Sure, they made mistakes. But, not only did they make mistakes, yes, they were people of their times. We look back from the 21st century and we think, goodness, I wouldn't have done things quite like that. Well, we partly stand on their shoulders in making that judgment. But if you look at them in the context of their times, it's a matter of historical record that it was often the missionaries and the missionaries alone who stood between indigenous peoples and Western adventurers who simply wanted to use and abuse them. And even PBS, hardly a friend of Christianity, admitted that about 3 or 4 years ago in a special that it produced on this topic. When I was studying in Boston back in the late 80s, the Boston Globe had a special on black leaders, lift out special, looking at 10 or 12 major leaders from Africa. And time and again, these leaders said, we, if anybody, can tell you about the mistakes missionaries made. We know that we're on the ground, but we're here to tell you that they were the only ones who brought us education and medicine, and we would not be here today if it wasn't for the work of these missionaries. And some missionary sending organizations in those days, particularly the ones sending missionaries to West Africa, would not accept you as a candidate unless you had your own coffin. Because you would be dead within 3 to 12 months of going to West Africa, and still they went. There's a reason why there are so many African Christians today, and it's not because they all just dropped out of the sky. It's because of the thousands of unknown individuals, unknown to us, definitely known to God, as one day we'll all know, who gave their lives because they followed one who gave his life for others. Black leaders recognised that, the extraordinary self-sacrifice of the missionaries. What about Canada? Has there been any Christian influence in Canada? John Stackhouse tells me, even though we talk about Canada not being very Christian these days, in terms of social institutions, it's incredibly Christian. And why? Because we are living with great social programs that were implemented in the late 19th and early 20th century, and they were implemented by largely evangelical Christian politicians. Go back and read the Toronto newspapers from the turn of the century and just be amazed at the theological language that's being used by politicians. And they tell us they want to keep religion out of politics. We would not have had this country with all of these social institutions if it had not been for Christian politicians who are convinced that this was their God and their bounden duty, God-given and bounden duty, to take care of people less well-off than themselves. George Brown founded the Globe, now become the Globe and Mail. And why did he do it? He's probably the single most important figure in terms of the Federation of Canada. He was a champion of individual rights over against the government, and he knew if people were going to vote well, they had to be well informed. And as a Christian, he founded a newspaper to make sure people knew what was going on, because he knew that Canadian Federation depended upon a well-informed public. Folks, Christians ought to be holding the media accountable. And you see stuff in the papers that you know is not right, write a letter. Be friendly, write a letter and tell them. You might think your letter doesn't count. It does. They all count. He was offered the Lieutenant Governorship of Ontario and a knighthood because of his work, and he refused. Why? Because of his Christian convictions. He wanted to remain a man of the people. Sounds a bit like Jesus. Edgerton Ryerson, 1803 to 1880, the father of public education in Canada. Public education in Canada is a Christian innovation. And then they try to tell us we don't want religion in the schools. There wouldn't be schools if there hadn't been people who are committed to a Christian worldview. Now, he argued for education along non-denominational lines, which is what it means when it says you don't want sectarian education. It never meant education without a religious component. It meant that no one denomination should be controlling it. And that's one of the sad things, the denominational history of Christians fighting one another. Father Charles Pendosi saved thousands during the conflicts between Indians and settlers and taught that the two had to learn how to live together and to treat one another with respect. John Robson, recognise the street of that name, 1824 to 1892, journalist, reformer, legislator, cabinet minister and premier, again played a crucial role in education, and argued that Canadian education ought surely to rest on Christian principles. He was particularly critical of the Cooley system, which was abusing Chinese and other minority peoples in this province. William Howland, reforming mayor of Toronto, elected in the face of big business interests and on his concern for the poor and the working person. Matthew Begbie, brought law to the wild outlying regions of BC, and saw Christianity as an essential element of law in this province. Leonard Tilley, William Dawson, go on and on and on. George Grant, Oliver Mowat, Nathaniel Burwash, John Buchan, Nellie McClung, Agnes MacPhail, actually the first female member of parliament and a Christian woman. Somewhat different from the MacPhail we might know today. Often goes unremarked. I saw just recently on the news, they had, I was at Valencia, was there, Lech Valencia was talking to the people in, where is it now? It's gone from my mind. In the Ukraine, yep. And it mentioned that he was one of the stalwarts of the democracy movement, failed to mention the role that Christianity played in Poland and Solidarity, and in Romania. What's the matter with our media? Why is it so blinkered that it simply can't bring itself to mention?